You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
And together we're agitating for change in Northern BC. In this episode, which we've entitled Community, Not Commodity, we'll consider the intersection of racism and capitalism and how many farmers in the North operate on the belief that equal access to food should automatically be a way of life. In this episode, we want to take you on a tour of the remarkable Indigenous project called Tea Creek Farm, where we learned that Jake Beaton's biggest challenge as a farmer isn't war, growing conditions, or food waste. The people he feeds don't struggle with affordability because Jacob distributes mass amounts of food for free to anyone who wants it. The biggest challenge at Tea Creek is racism. Jacob is training Indigenous farmers and distributing food within systems that logically should be supporting him. Kinda like the soap fairy that just keeps growing in adverse conditions, hoping to attract adventurous eaters. Then, I want to take you to a modest event I attended in September called the Farm Folk City Folk Tour and Dinner, hosted at Wood Grain Farm. I'm going to share a couple of brief conversations I had there, one with Jonathan Knight, one of a small handful of grain farmers, and Hannah Stockner, a chef who uses mostly local ingredients in her menu from farms like Wood Grain. Just like the gentle work Jacob Beaton is doing in Kitwanga despite his challenges, Jonathan and Hannah demonstrate beautifully how food brings people together. Time to check the pot and see what's cooking. The Indigenous have always sensibly hunted, fished, and foraged whatever was available in northern BC. Just look at the humble soapberry, which thrives in the north despite adverse weather conditions. This tiny fruit is often dismissed because of its soapy, bitter flavor. And yet the Indigenous discovered that when you beat it with a little water, the soapberry becomes a delicious treat called soapberry cloud, packed with vitamin C, fiber, and antioxidants. In season, that humble berry appears as a cherished traditional guest at most cultural events. It's a subtle reminder of how many northern farmers, Indigenous and settler alike, prioritize nourishing their community over personal profit. Google the question, "Is there enough food to feed the world?" and you'll learn that there's plenty. For one thing, there's an abundance of fruit growing naturally all over these mountains. And yet, hunger persists. There are larger factors like war, climate change, food waste, and inequality. In northern BC, we have significant challenges at our grocery stores with access, distribution, and affordability. In the spring of 2025, Ideas Lab participants, funded by the Public Health Association of BC, were invited to spend a day at Tea Creek Farm. Tea Creek Farm in Kitwanga is an award-winning Indigenous-led land-based training center focused on Indigenous food sovereignty, cultural revitalization, and skilled trades training for Indigenous people. Jacob Beaton is a Tsimshian entrepreneur whose traditional name means an eagle who gets things done. His partner Jessica Ouellette, along with their sons Noah and Ezra, all contribute enormously to the success of Tea Creek Farm. When Brenda and I arrived at the farm, we had not intended it as an interview day, but as we listened to Jacob explain his challenges, the content was compelling. We'll begin this segment of the episode with Jacob explaining how the many programs work together. Tea Creek is like a small town.
And trying to find somebody who had the skills, knowledge, expertise that could come and actually repair them was nearly impossible and very expensive. Mm-hmm. So then it was like, okay, so we need to train heavy-duty mechanics, right? So it actually started with that. And that, my eldest son Noah, that was his passion, and that's what he really got into, was fixing machines. So you're absolutely right. I mean, we dream about eventually having our own store, market, whatever you want to call it. Like, we're hoping the longhouse will become that, like that it'll be a space we're going to start it very soon, where we're going to do like flea markets here. We've been preparing for it for the last few weeks. And then we're hoping it catches on with the community, and then there's all kinds of like things that are like we want to do, like repair. We're doing Wild Wednesdays, and we're also wanting to add Repair Wednesdays. So we just see so many households that aren't functioning properly just because something breaks down, and it's a simple fix, but they don't know how to fix it, so it stays broken down. Yeah. So we see that a lot at the garbage dump here. We'll go and pick up perfectly fine fridges that just need to be the dust blown out of them or whatever. Yeah. So the hope is to kind of contribute that way as well, like learn how to maintain and fix your stuff so you can stay, stay on your 2 feet.
Jacob would regularly intersperse these inspiring explanations with comments on the reality of the shocking funding discrepancies that he's experienced.
The same program, they offered $7,000 We protested and they doubled it to 14,000, and it was for exactly the same deliverable. It had to be the same quality feasibility study. We delivered it, and then I didn't learn about the funding discrepancy until I went to the first BC Association of Food Hubs, and then they found out that we only got 14,000, and they freaked out. They're like, we all got 50,000. So I went back to the ministry and like WTF guys, and they're like, well, that's because you're First Nations. And that's the, we were only supposed to give you 7 because you're First Nations, and you're lucky we gave you 14. So anyway, so we deal with like a ton of racism, a ton of discrimination, and where the reason we're not funded is just simply racist policies that still exist either in people's minds or organizationally within ministries, where they literally have written rules that say you can only fund a First Nation person or entity or organization this much. And if you're not First Nations, it's this much. So that's what we're dealing with all over the place. Right now it's in this area where I'm very frustrated finding out that they funded a non-First Nations company in Vancouver millions and millions of dollars to deliver the same type of training. Actually, when I was touring their site and their program, we'd already figured out all the stuff they were trying to figure out. Right? I was like, we've already done this, we know how to do this, right? Yeah. So yeah, it's heartbreaking for us, but it's also just reality. So yeah, so what we can do is we're getting a lot of support from the general public right now, which is the really good news. So the nonprofit society is kind of is taking off, and the funding levels are currently climbing there. So what we're looking at right now is just cutting most of our on-site services, which are very expensive, and focusing more on the nonprofit. If things don't change in the next few months, we can just be like, yeah, we're going to start focusing on our network, do a lot more stuff online because that's cheap, and we'll just shift things over towards that, and we'll cut a lot of the stuff. So yeah, so that's it. I mean, it's just how it works. I have lots of friends in both for-profit and nonprofit world that I always get to talk to, and you know, do some ground truthing and find out how things are going in the rest of the world, so, yeah.
During the tour of the grounds, we stopped at a field dedicated to merging ancient indigenous food technology with modern technologies, what Jacob called food forest revitalization. It's basically giving people the ability to forage in your own front yard.
Where we basically used a very, very heavy mulches, and the whole idea, which I'm a pretty big fan of, and it worked really, really well, is that you're really boosting the soil biology and ecosystem around the crop that you're growing there long term. It worked incredibly well. The berries were very vigorous and almost overproductive because with the heavy mulching, they were allowed to kind of grow in a limited space. And so their energy was kind of going towards the plants. And then it was a little out of control and we started removing the mulches, I think it was last year. Yeah. And so then we got a whole bunch of the runners and shoots and stuff going a little crazy. So we started at the top. We're working our way down and removing the berries and strawberries and raspberries. And then we're going to replant them other places on the farm, offer them out to the community. We got lots. So, yeah. And we're bringing in some new varieties as well, which is going to be fun. So a big part of what we're doing, we're still waiting to hear back on a grant. We're really hopeful it'll come through, because we self-funded the beginnings of this, but it's food forest revitalization. So basically going in where there's remnants of raspberries, strawberries, Saskatoons, apple, cherry, hazelnuts, snowberries, and bringing in some of our modern varieties of those same species and then encouraging them because we go, they're there for a reason, and they're in very clear patches throughout the food forest here at TC. So this whole food forest zone is basically, we're on the old Gitsan highways here, so we're literally standing very close to what was the grease trail to Andamal. And then there was the trail going up to Gitnyau, Gitwingak, and then another one that crossed right over here to Kispiox. So this place was a traditional meeting place, and it was also food lined all the trails. And so what we see here is absolutely crazy abundance of natural food, but it's been neglected for a long time, and it's not, a lot of these species are not natural competitors. They do rely on people to harvest them and care for them and, you know, do some care. And so a lot of them have been under stress and have been actually reducing, you know, like, so they don't, like, wild raspberries aren't incredibly competitive. Like, they need, you know, they need, yeah, they need space, all right, and they'd like it to be a little bit open. So when they start growing in, the, for example, the wild raspberry patches will shrink. And we're seeing that with a lot of the stuff in the food forest where we're like, oh my goodness, you know, you can see where the patches used to be and there's just a few survivors hanging on, and then we want to go in. So that's a big part of what we're doing. We already ordered in a whole ton of more berries and a big diversity. And for us, the question that's, because I talked to, like, you know, horticulturists and red seals and scientists and stuff, and they were actually quite negative about this because they're like, if you take a domestic into an indigenous, the indigenous species will spread its disease to the domestic. And that's what I heard pretty universally. But what I observe here from farming here now for 5 years is that what the diversity, biodiversity in the food forest provides is incredible abundance of predators and beneficials. So, and temperature controls. So what we're seeing is that in the extreme heat, the food forest is 10 degrees cooler than outside the food forest. It's crazy. It's been 38 degrees here, and you go into the food forest and it's 29, 30 degrees. Okay? But then on top of that, I've never ever had to use anything, not even an organic pesticide here, right? Because the natural predators are here in crazy abundance. Like, our first year, I went to go do some spraying because some of our stuff was overwhelmed with aphids, and I went and I got this organic spray and I went to start spraying, and I stopped because spiders were everywhere. Yeah. They were just covering everything. I think I took one squirt and I saw like 5 spiders drop off the plant. I'm like, whoa, wait. And then I started looking and I'm like, oh no, like, I'll just wait till tomorrow. And sure enough, the spiders did all the work for me and the aphids were gone the next day. So we have a lot of that here. It's not just insect predators, but we have snakes and we have toads and frogs and hawks, and there's an endangered falcon that nests nearby, and they'll literally fly over our fields patrolling them, and so we never have mice take over. Like, it's really incredible. So that's kind of what we're working with, is seeing how we can merge this ancient indigenous food technology with some of our modern food technology to have a more hopeful future, because right now it feels pretty bleak when you're out there in plus 40 degrees and Kitwanga going, how are we going to survive this? This is crazy. This is the size of an average front yard or backyard on reserve. We actually measured it out, and this is the size and area that you'll find on a typical Indian reserve. And so we show people that you can grow, if you're just kind of calling it in, you can grow 3,000 pounds of food here in a year, which is enough for like a couple people. And then if you go hard at it and you basically use 100% of your space, then you can grow 7,000 pounds of food in the space, which we did in 2020. And in fact, we had to cut the size of the field because we couldn't even give it away. There was so much produce. We did giveaways all of July and August, and then we still had to compost, I think, 4,000 pounds of vegetables. Wow. Because it turned out we were growing the wrong kind of veg for our local market. That was the issue. We were growing tons of greens and lettuces, and, you know, because you go to the store and a lettuce is like $5-6, and who's gonna eat lettuce at $5 or $6? And we were selling it for less than half the price, and that was a great success. We actually took over 16 linear feet of the local grocery store, like, you know, all the shelves. It was all our produce for a good part of the season, and then we still were overproducing like mad. So anyways, it's a great way where we teach basically high intensity growing for your own, you know, family, local food sovereignty. And and it's also low cost, right? So we just use relatively basic hand tools that aren't gonna, you know, hopefully not gonna break the bank. So that's the barn field.
We then toured an enormous and extremely successful root cellar that Tea Creek participants have built. I wish you could see just how much food was being stored there.
Done by July. Oh, nice. And we didn't even have the funding to design it, so we literally had to design and build April, May, June, and then it had to be done by July. So we had 3 months to design and build this, and we did it all locally. So all local design. We went through multiple design rounds and kind of getting feedback from people and how, you know, all the different considerations. And then it was built. And so like when you're upstairs again, all the timbers were milled right here in the bandsaw mill. Everything was stained and painted, the concrete. Our crew watched YouTube videos the couple days before and studied and learned how to do concrete. I had a guy from Vancouver who's a Red Seal carpenter, and he's like, this is better than most of the Red Seals in Vancouver. I just love this building because it's a proof that we can do it. I just keep telling people, like, we keep hearing how we can't do it for whatever reason. Well, we got to bring people in from a city, or we got to bring people from, you know, who aren't. And I'm like, no, this is proof again, on top of all this other proof that we can do it. So I'm very, very proud of this building. And then we pulled together some extra monies to do the upstairs because the funding was just for the cellar. So we did the upstairs that you're going to be enjoying today as well. And it worked out, I think, very, very well. So normally this time of year, our sea potato would be sprouting because it used to be below the Green Roof Cabin. And we had a cool box system, which was an air conditioner, and it wasn't quite enough. And it couldn't quite keep cold enough. And so by this time, the potatoes, especially on the top shells, have sprouts usually, you know, 6 inches long. So it's a really nice testament that our vegetables are still kind of hibernating and not sprouting yet. And that's good because we eat the potatoes right through until the next harvest. Yeah. So all those meals I've talked about, like we pull the potatoes out of the root cellar to serve those meals. And so it's nice to have it stay for correct temperature and humidity. And then we got the two bays for doing different kinds of vegetables that you don't want to have the gases combining, setting each other off. This bay is passively cooled mostly because it's fully buried. And then that bay there is actively cooled. We were going to put a cool bot in, and then we were this close, and then we were like, oh, let's just splurge, you know, like, let's just, you know, so we splurged on the proper, you know, cooling system. Doors are made in Telqua, actually, insulated doors, yeah. Trusses were all made right here at Tea Creek, which you can't see because it's all covered now, but yeah, no, it's a really cool example of local building and local construction.
To end this segment, I want to share a few more comments on the disappointing disparity between the First Nations and those comfortable organizations that have an army of grant writers. We need to do better.
So in one of my first businesses, I was a communications community engagement specialist with my First Nations company and had a client. And so I did the first strategic plan and stuff. And one of the things I really focused on is making the application process as easy as possible, because what we saw in the community engagements is you'd have these impoverished First Nations who desperately need the money and no capacity to apply for it. And then you'd see these wealthy communities and nations that had an army of grant writers, and they just keep attracting more money. So we're like, no, we have to like flip the script here and make it easier for the organizations and communities that need the money to get the money. Right?
Yeah.
So I think that was quite successful with NRT, because we applied for NRT money and it was one page.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, oh, this is great. They're still doing that. That's great. You know? But so yeah, there's that. That's the good thing. And I think the only solution to it, which is what we're doing through our association, is to get your boots on the ground and go see what's real and what's not. Like, that's really the solution, is like show up and be like, yeah, these people are actually doing it and they've got the people to do it, and you know, they've got the right leadership, because it's really hard to tell from just paper whether something's real or not, or whether it's good or bad or whatever.
Yeah, it'd be great if there was more accountability with fund disbursement, because sometimes you feel like,
Yeah. And you know what the reporting should be? My favorite report was actually, I think it might have been from Public Health Association of BC. I can't remember. It was one of the ones being run out of Prince George. And I remember we were just doing a check-in call, and we'd already spent the grant. And so I had my computer, and I was just like, oh, here you go. Here's what we did here, and here's what we did here. And I just showed them. And they were so happy. They're like, this is the best report ever. Okay, your reporting's done. That's how it should be. Like, you should be like, yeah, take your phone, and this is what we did with the money. And then your report's done. That'd be great if everyone accepted those.
You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot, agitating for change in Northern BC. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
Before the break, we took a tour of Key Creek Farm with Jacob Beaton. Under the capitalist paradigm, food is commodified, meaning that access to it in most communities is dictated by market forces, income, and profit rather than nutrition. Capitalist economies tend to produce an abundance of food while simultaneously creating food insecurity using tools like inequity, stigma, and racism. The many kindnesses that Brenda and I witnessed at Tea Creek Farm, where both farming skills and food were shared among community members extravagantly and with abandon, reminded us that while the capitalist paradigm is an obligatory part of our economy, farmers can work around it to the greater good. Next up, a couple of brief conversations from an event I attended in September called the Farm Folk City Folk Tour and Dinner, hosted at Wood Grain Farm. Jonathan Knight is a farmer and baker and co-owner of Wood Grain Farm in the Kispiaks, and Hannah Stockner is the head chef and co-owner of the Kispiaks River Lodge. Jonathan and Hannah also demonstrated that you can feed your community nutritious local food and promote food sovereignty. Jonathan Knight is an organic farmer and Red Seal journeyman baker. He established two social enterprise bakeries in Canada and is the founder of an organic craft bread bakery and mill on Vancouver Island. Jonathan is an experienced small-scale grain grower, stone miller, mill builder, and oven builder.
David, we haven't talked to anybody about grains yet. I think probably because the assumption is that you can't, it's not good conditions up here for growing grains. Is that your experience?
Yeah, I would say we're on the margins. So we can, and I mean, in the past, people have grown a lot of grain here, a lot more than, you know, definitely than we do. We do it on very much a micro scale, more from interest sake than anything else, and to show that, yeah, we can do it, but it's challenging.
Okay.
It's like the, as I mentioned, it's the wet climate, the wet falls, or at least the inconsistent, you know, fall weather that we get makes it difficult. Especially when you're harvesting with a combine, that you know, if you're on a small enough scale that you can either cut it and stook it and dry it naturally, once you have a nice weather window, or if you have some kind of grain dryer or some way to finish drying it down post harvest.
So is it the production element, or is it also the growing element that's the challenge?
It's both. It would be to scale up, you'd need to invest in probably a grain dryer, which is usually powered by propane or gas, so
right.
There's that footprint to it. And yeah, you would need the handling equipment, which does not really exist around here. I mean, there is some grain grown, as you probably know, around Smithers.
Yeah.
Mostly animal grain. So
right.
So there is
so we don't
the,
need the same
infrastructure
quality there,
to do
right?
it. Yeah. The ultimately the for human grade grain, you need a certain quality to the grain to begin with, especially wheat. You need a sufficient protein level, but you also need it's a measure called the falling number, which is how close to sprouting the grain is. So especially if you have a wet fall and the grain starts to think about sprouting, then it makes it very difficult to reliably ferment in baked goods.
Right.
So you want, you know, you need to harvest it before the grain starts to think about, oh, it's time to wake up and, you know, maybe start a new generation.
So it's a fine balance if you're going to be a miller then up here.
Yeah.
So one of my childhood dreams was to be a miller, but it was because I walked into a very old building that used to have the wheel mill on it, and it was a very romantic situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then they started explaining how much dust gets into the air and how hard it is to breathe,
mm-hmm.
and how inconsistent the weather can be, and the water can be inconsistent, and you know, it was always one of the first things, if there was a war, that was one of the first things that they always took out, so
yeah.
That's why nobody wants to be a miller.
Yeah, no, milling, I mean, it definitely was a craft as much as farming is, as much as baking is, which are, you know, mostly lost skills at this point.
Yeah. Which is sad, in my opinion. I think it would be lovely to bring back some of those skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tied to the land.
Yeah. Yeah, like, what makes more sense to me is to grow, like, when we're growing on our small scale, especially when we're often losing a whole field because it's too wet or because the bears get in, you know, it's a lot of work, a lot of fuel that goes into, and a lot of time that goes into working up a field to be able to plant grain on a small scale. it's not very efficient.
Right, right.
So grain, once it's harvested and dried, it's very stable. It doesn't deteriorate, or at least not very quickly. You know, grain is good for us. It's the seed, right? It's an intact seed, so it stays stable for some years. So grain is something that does perhaps make sense. You know, if we look at what foods do make more sense to ship around and to grow in places that the climate's better suited, grain is probably best grown on the east side of the Rockies, where you have the more, you know, more favorable conditions for it. But to mill it locally so that you have it, you know, that's where the freshness comes in. It's not between harvest and milling, it's between milling and eating.
Right.
So yeah, it makes much more sense if we're looking at food security here and having sort of increasing the quality of the food that we're eating, then it makes more sense to look at establishing a milling operation that can then take, you know, grain by the tanker load or by the train car potentially.
Right.
From the regions that they do grow grain very well on a very large scale than us messing around with our little machines on, you know, small acreages.
So there was another comment that surprised me.
Grain doesn't go bad, milled flour. So the grain is the intact seed. So once it's broken up, then, you know, it degrades. It's oxygen is introduced to it and it's, you know, the seed is destroyed. It's no longer a living matter once it's ground.
So the stuff that we're getting at the Safeway.
So, yeah, it should be used as freshly as possible. That said, as a baker, you don't necessarily want, like, there needs to be a little bit of aging between grinding it. It's more of a white flour thing when you start refining it down, but there are downsides to it being too fresh for the baking quality, for getting sort of consistency in the loaves.
One of the people that we talked to, Daniel Sins, was indigenous, and he said that his ancestors were given flour because the colonizers were trying really hard to get them off of their traditional foods and onto the same old stuff, and then they'd be reliant on them for trade, right? And the indigenous had no idea what to do with this stuff, and they were finally throwing it in the fire and enjoying the fireworks that resulted. How does that make you feel as somebody who loves grain and loves growing it yourself here? I mean, this doesn't really have a history here. And to see that, I mean, I love that new things are coming in, that people are bringing in something that we haven't normally seen here. And, you know, traditional is great, but it's not everything.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting history.
Yeah, it's grain is a fairly efficient way to feed a lot of people. And especially as people either don't have the skills or the time or the interest in producing their own food, growing their own food, foraging their own food. You know, ultimately people are getting food from food producers. So grain and the good things it produces, mainly breads, and the craft behind that are skills that can feed a lot of people, feed a large part of the population. And right now we're so reliant on a bag called bread that comes from like very large factories very far from here that we're shipping around. So it's nutriently very poor. It's flavor-wise, there's not much to it.
Yeah.
And it's being shipped, and obviously it's mostly air because modern supermarket loaves are so light. But those light, you know, balloons of air, basically they're being shipped from either Alberta or the Lower Mainland. Like, that's a very, very inefficient way to be moving food around and trying to feed a whole lot of people. So yeah, if we had local mills that we could take grain that's grown in places that it can be done very efficiently, and if we had the skilled millers to be able to produce the flour and the skilled bakers to be able to make nutritious food out of it, then, you know, that can sustain our communities and sustain a lot of people, as people aren't baking at home anymore or necessarily growing big gardens or having their, you know, little plot of grain, because it's surprising how little an area of grains, of wheat, you would need to be able to support a family. It doesn't really take that much land to be able to, you know, if you had your little few acre homestead, you could definitely grow all your vegetables, but you could probably grow a large amount of your bread as well.
Grow a lot of things that the average person doesn't grow. You know, Jolene said we have tobacco growing here, and now you've got grains growing here and perennials. And I love that you're experimenting with things because it's not the same old, same old. That's where my mindset goes, what can we do with this? Rather than, let's have carrots again tonight because it's simple and I know what to do with it.
That's why we're here. That's what has drawn us both to this lifestyle, is we like learning.
Yeah.
And there's a lifetime to learn with doing what we're doing. So
that's very inspiring. Yeah. Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, and the farm has evolved and it will continue to keep evolving because there's just so much to be learned from it. And, you know, by doing things and experimenting, we get better at different things as well. So we're able to get more efficient with some things, and which frees up us some more time to play around with other things and try some more experiments. So,
which brings us to the comment that it's a good thing to fail sometimes because that's where you learn.
Oh yeah, there's ample opportunity for learning around here.
Hannah Stockner is the head chef and co-owner of the Kispiox River Lodge, whose mission statement is to be a social hub for the Hazeltons area that cultivates community empowerment and supports local awesomeness.
So Hannah, we've talked to a lot of people who grow food, who produce food, who distribute food, but we haven't talked to any chefs. And I'm curious to know what you see as the value of seed saving and getting food right off the land. Like, you've got it as fresh as it's going to be and you get to cook with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, number one thing that is coming to mind is really seeds. That's where food, like our food comes from. Like, we're not going to have the food if we don't save the seeds and use the seeds and plant the seeds and grow the seeds. And so the food itself, and being able to learn how to harvest seeds and save them and all that is super important, so that we have people who are knowledgeable enough to use them and grow them and grow the food. So then someone that, like me, can step in and use the food that has been grown and have the food, like, and that is just the best way to eat, is grown right there, used right there, eaten right there.
One of the things that Jolene kept saying to us while we did the interview with her was, it's really important that we preserve the diversity of seeds, that we experiment with it, that we see what it will happen with it, and that we're not limiting what the seeds can do, but we build in a little bit of resilience depending on the different climates that we're going to see. And that must be of real value to you too, because then you can be a little more creative with what you're cooking.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I come here to like Jonathan and Jolene's farm, for example, and they're showing me, we've got this growing and this growing and this growing, and it's like, oh, I didn't even know we could grow that up here. And so exactly, just experimenting and see what we can grow. And then, there's no harm, really, in just planting a seed and seeing if it grows. And with climate changing and all of that, maybe things grow differently, and maybe things grow worse, maybe things grow better. So it's super important to, keep experimenting with planting seeds and growing seeds and see how it works, see what environments work better, see what times of year work better. And so, that's super important, is to just always experiment and see, because then we will see what we're able to grow and use and how we're able to use it, and some things we can use differently and than others and in different ways. And just seeds themselves are, I'm learning from doing this dinner here tonight, are really cool to eat themselves. Because, normally, lots of plant the seeds and grow things, but you can also eat the certain seeds. So that's, a food source right there, too. And, super cool to do all kinds of stuff with that. And it's just such a vast world of food itself as a whole, and agriculture is just such a vast world, and it's super important that we continue to experiment and trial and error and see what works and see what doesn't, and feed people this and feed people that, and keep it going.
You had a variety of kinds of beets, and that was one of the comments that Jolene made. See if you taste the difference in these different beets. Mm-hmm. I love that I'm allowed to be experimental in my tastes. Mm-hmm. That I'm allowed to come at something and say, this might work and this might not work, but I'm keen to try it.
Mm-hmm.
How exciting to be able to enjoy a meal that way.
Totally. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I love that. Just kind of discovering flavors. Maybe they're the same thing, but it's this is a little bit different. Eating things that are fresh from the farm versus buying it from the store, for example, there's such a difference in flavor and quality. It's insane. It's super fun when we're able to, especially experiment on the farm here, of two different types of beets. They look the same, but let's taste them and find out. That's just fun. And then we only will learn from there. Everything we do, failure or success, we will learn. The important part is to just keep doing it.
Maybe the journey is the best part of this.
Exactly. Totally. Yeah, yeah. That's what they say, right? It's about the journey, not the destination. Supporting the people who are digging their hands in the soil, no pun intended. But like Jonathan and Jolene here, who like have this amazing space and do what they're doing, like how they're teaching people to learn about this stuff so then they can go home and start like experimenting at home and like having a little more confidence to like do stuff on there. And then those people start to teach their neighbors and family and stuff about, look what I learned. And then that plants a seed in their mind. No, it's literally just like planting seeds and watching it grow in our minds and in our gardens is very important.
And to be able to say that they grew the grains, the bread that we enjoyed today, that's another element that we take for granted. You just go and you buy your bread at the grocery store, right? I was sitting there eating this meal and it was a colorful plate. There was a lot of textures to it. There were several things that I thought, I've never tried this, like squash, just raw. Mm-hmm. You just cut in a circle and it was beautiful and delicious. And I thought if we had equity in the world and everybody had access to fresh and local right on the farm like this, would anybody ever go to the grocery store again? There's no comparison.
No, there really isn't. The world right now, everything is very expensive and food costs and everything. So I think people have the mindset of like, oh, that's too expensive for me. But that's what you're putting in your body every day. It's quality. It's just the quality, quality, quality. It's so much better. So much better for us. So much better for everything to just have locally grown and to support that in any way we can.
Prioritizing that is really significant.
Totally.
I know, and on a limited budget like I am, and I'm a senior, people say to me, how can you afford that? Well, because I prioritize it.
Exactly. And how we nourish ourselves and look at food is very important. I'm super, super happy to be living where I am. Most of the people out here, our friends and neighbors, have little gardens and like have greenhouses and are doing this. And it's like, they got it figured out.
Yeah. This podcast was generously funded by the Public Health Association of BC. Brenda Barrett is my co-lead and the executive director of the Storytellers Society in Hazelton. Technical production by Christine Bruce. Music by Elijah Larson. Food experts in this episode were Jacob Beaton at Tea Creek Farm in Kitwanga, Jonathan Knight, a farmer and baker in the Kispiawks, and Hannah Stockner, head chef and co-owner of the Kispiawks River Lodge. A big shout out to all our local farmers and food producers in North Central BC. For more information on this or any other episode of Tempest in a Stockpot, visit storytellerssociety.org/tempest. Thank you for listening. I'm Christine Bruce, reminding you to stir that pot and buy local. Because small farmers don't have PR teams, subsidies, or corporate safety nets. They survive on community support. And all acts of kindness between neighbors are subversive acts. Just saying.